Our next speaker this morning is David Gross from ITP, who will talk about split string field theory.
Okay, I'm going to discuss some recent work with Wadi Taylor on an approach to open string field theory that we call split string field theory. And I'm going to start, and as described in these recent papers, and I'm going to start with some general remarks on open string field theory and try to put forward a strong point of view that string theory perhaps could be usefully regarded, perhaps even in a rather complete formulation, as a theory of open strings. And I'll just remind you of a few things you know very well that might be regarded as pointing in this direction, starting with the historical fact that closed strings were first discovered historically, experimentally within open string theory, even before it was known to be string theory, as singularities in open string so-called twisted channels, which we now realize are world sheet annulus diagrams. And in some sense, therefore, could be regarded as already present in the open string theory. First, these appeared as singularities in four dimensions where one was working at the time, and then it was shortly realized that in 26 dimensions, they appeared as ordinary poles and could be regarded, therefore, as asymptotic states of the theory, of a theory whose fundamental degrees of freedom are open strings. This, in fact, was the first place in string theory already 30 years ago where closed strings appeared, the critical dimension appeared, and the what I regard as perhaps the crucial feature of string theory, one which we're still not totally comfortable with and still really don't understand deeply because it's so unfield theoretic, namely the connection between the UV behavior of open strings and the infrared behavior of closed strings. The reason for the appearance of these singularities or poles, of course, is this connection. It is the ultraviolet behavior of this diagram, which corresponds to a one-loop open string diagram that produces at finite energies or in the infrared closed string singularities. It's this connection that allows string theory to produce gravitons out of open strings, not as bound states. They should not be thought of as bound states, but rather, in a sense, I think, as simply ultraviolet open strings. In other words, open strings, of course, can become closed strings. And here, one is producing the closed strings, not some dynamical mechanism, but for arbitrarily weak coupling of open string theory, which produces closed string states, whose coupling is the square of the open string coupling. So I don't know a good name. We should come up with a good name to replace bound states by something different, uvions or something. These are, in other words, in some sense, we should perhaps think of closed strings as simply ultraviolet open strings in this dual sense. Now, that immediately makes it conceivable that we might capture all of the properties of closed string by, in terms of a formulation where the only fundamental degrees of freedom are open strings. And this has many, many advantages, this point of view. Now, someone who was convinced for many years that open string theories were ugly, and that once we had the heterotic string, which gave us the right gauge groups without having any open strings, why consider open strings at all? It really took a lot of evidence to change one's point of view, but the recent evidence, of course, is overwhelming. First of all, we have the dualities of string theory, which tell us that even theories which purport to be purely closed string theories with no open strings are dual to, can be related by dualities to theories with open strings. But most important, we have the existence of D-brains. And D-brains that appear in closed-string theories have to be thought of, in my opinion, as solitons of open-string theory, simply because their tensions are have the natural scaling in terms of the open-string coupling, and their low-energy dynamics is that of open strings. So closed-string theories, naturally, even if we didn't know about these dualities and only knew about D-brains, the D-brains, of course, are necessary to understand these dualities, we find things which are naturally explainable as solitons of open string theories, even though the open strings don't appear in these closed string theories. Therefore, perhaps it's useful to change the point of view and say that what you thought was a closed string theory, or described as a closed string theory, really should be described as an open string theory in which the D-brains are the solitons. The ADS-CFT correspondence is, in fact, a marvelous example of a particular background in 2B string theory where one has a complete, one believes in the strongest possible form of the Malvicina conjecture, that one has a complete correspondence between closed string theory in a particular background and not just open string theory, but in this case, because of the infinite warp factor, if you want a the low energy limit of this open string field theory, namely supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory in four dimensions, or the other ADS-CFT correspondences. So in this case, in fact, one knows that a particularly simple limit of open string field theory in this case should be able to reproduce all the physics of closed string theory in the bulk. Now, of course, this example shows some of the limitations of the approach, or the difficulties of the approach. To capture even just the full moduli space of 2B theory, we would need to add to perturb the supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory on the boundary by operators that are non-renormalizable and uncontrollable. And so the attempt to try to lift this perhaps non-perturbative formulation of 2B string theory in a particular background to a larger setting gives us difficulties that we do not know how to handle. It is very interesting that there is one perturbation of the bulk theory, perturbation of the bulk theory, namely turning on a B field, which again in a particular decoupling limit gives us a very simple modification of the low energy theory, of the field theory, that of non-commutative field theory, which is indeed corresponds, if one were to perturb in the deformation parameter theta, an infinite number of irrelevant operators which one couldn't control, yet one, when one sums them as instructed by string theory, one ameliorates, in fact, the ultraviolet behavior and gets a behavior that is better defined in the ultraviolet. String theory has no ultraviolet problems, so that if we had control over open string field theory, we would presumably be able to handle this problem, not just in the case of a theta deformation, but in case of the other deformations that are necessary to capture the full moduli space of type 2B theory. In any case, and by the way, in that deformation, the theta parameter deformation, where one gets non-commutative field theory, one gets an example which already begins to capture the stringy nature of the boundary theory. In other words, the boundary theory now contains solitons, which are the D-brains of the type 2B theory. And one also begins to see the singularities in the closed string channels that occur because of the UV infrared connection. So this example of non-commutative field theory, I think so far, is the best example we have of the ability of open string theory to capture much of the closed string physics. Now, the natural approach to an attempt of this type, of course, is string field theory. And I gather that you've heard some talks on that, so I can be very brief in much of that. So let me remind you of open string field theory, which was formulated 15 years ago by Ed. It's a beautiful abstract algebraic formulation of the Chern-Simons-like theory involving string fields, a derivation, a star product, an integral, where the string fields are elements of, in abstractly, of some graded algebra. And Q is a derivation of that algebra. We have an integral. And Q, as a, by a derivation, we mean Q is a nilpotent map of the algebra into itself. It's a derivation of the algebra. And this abstract formulation is very nice. It's the kind of abstract formulation that one would like, which seems to have no reference to anything to do with strings or the background. This is pretty background independent, except when you try to realize it. So this is sort of too abstract. And its realizations within string theory, as you know, involve the choice of a BRST operator or a background conformal field theory, which has to do, if you want, with a quote-unquote closed string background, as well as a precise definition of these various elements here in the formulation of the theory, star product, which wouldn't define as an overlap, the star product of two string functionals. So the string field here was represented as a functional on the coordinates of the string. Here I've exhibited just the matter coordinates, the positions of the bosonic string, and one takes the star product by equating the right-hand side of psi with the left-hand side of phi, approximately. To make true sense out of this, one has to worry about so-called midpoint insertions, deal with the ghosts, and to be make this precise, realize this product either using techniques of conformal field theory, the kind that Ashok described yesterday in his talk, or as operators on a Fock space of appropriate for whatever background conformal field theory one is discussing, one wishes to use. So the background independence is lost in writing down this realization. One has to choose both a background in defining Q and in defining the star product and so on, and the actual space of functionals, as we will see. Now, recently, the open string field theory, like many other things in string theory, goes through ups and downs. Sometimes the downs are pretty long. This one, open string field theory, was regarded with abhorrence by almost anyone who's worked on it for years and years because it's so difficult. And it really was the beautiful, powerful conjectures of Sen that revived the subject. And I don't have to remind you of these conjectures. They've been discussed by Ashok and by Barton, I gather, in detail. But let me put them in the context of the point of view I'm trying to put forward. So Sen conjectured that that if we look at the 26-dimensional bosonic open string theory, thought of in modern terms as the physics of space-filling D25 brains, where now, this theory notoriously has a tachyon at the classical level, and we can regard, in a modern sense, that tachyon is simply that being indicative of the fact that D brains, bosonic theory, annihilate either with themselves or with other D brains and can decay. And Sen suggested that those D brains will annihilate, the tachyon will roll down the hill. But there could very well be a stable vacuum after the D-brains have annihilated, which contain no D-brains, classically, contain no D-brains, and classically, therefore, should describe no open strings, because the D-brains have disappeared. So this stable vacuum should have no physical open string states, but it has every reason to have the same closed string states that it has in any D-brain background, including no D-brain background. So that this stable vacuum, the bottom, classically stable, he suggested, is just closed string field theory. It's just the closed string theory in 26 bosonic, the bosonic clustering theory in 26 dimensions. If so, then here is a great example of what you might have regarded the purely closed string theory being described in terms of open string fields in which there are no physical states. Okay, so at this background, perturbatively, there are no degrees of freedom, physical degrees of freedom at all. And yet, the theory is not trivial. It has solitons. The solitons would be, in fact, these unstable solitons, the D-branes themselves, and the small fluctuations around the unstable solitons would have physical modes. They would describe the ordinary bosonic open string degrees of freedom. And then, even more, if one starts calculating loops, one would find other physical states, namely the closed string physical states that one finds in open string scattering amplitudes. Here one could find them by constructing off-shell correlation functions of open string operators and discovering poles in the closed string channels. There is a lot of evidence that you've heard about for this picture, both numerical and analytic and boundary open string conformal field theory approaches. And what I'm going to describe is what Waddy and I call split string field theory, whose goals, long-range goals, are really to achieve analytic control of the equations of motion of classical string theory and prove these conjectures exactly, find the solutions that correspond to all of these tachyons, and allow one to shift from one extreme of the classical theory to another, find the closed string sector of the theory, and so on. But one of the other goals is to exhibit the gauge invariant observables of open string theory. So again, I'd like to come back just briefly and generally to the point that there's a lot of advantage to the point of view that you can get all of closed string physics out of a theory whose fundamental degrees of freedom are those of open strings. The main advantage is, just like in ADS-CFT, that you don't have to face up in that formulation, in the open string formulation of the theory, to all the problems that plague quantum gravity. Gravity is an emergent phenomenon. In quantum gravity, we have no idea, even at the classical level, how to describe observables, except for the S matrix. And we can't even describe experiments that are done every day in our laboratories. But in open string theories, or ordinary gauge theories, we have no such problem. We can describe a lot more than the S matrix, and we know how to relate local observables to S matrix calculations. The same is true in ADS-CFT. We have, on the boundary, both gauge invariant local operators, which correspond indeed to S matrix elements of the bulk gravity theory. We also have observables like expectation values of big Wilson loops, which whose meaning in the bulk theory, I'm not exactly sure what it is. It's something one can calculate in string theory in the semi-classical approximation by summing over closed string world sheets that terminate at the boundary. But what the supergravity, if you want, the physical interpretation of those gravitational observables are, is unclear. And yet the strategy for getting all the observables of a open string theory or of a gauge theory is clear. The final goal, of course, is to cast the open string field theory in an abstract enough framework, which is better defined than the totally abstract framework that Ed put forward, so that one can work with it and find different backgrounds as solutions. And that would be perhaps the beginning of a non-perturbative background independent formulation of all of string theory. Now, of course, so we're starting here with a very simple case and trying to move towards that direction. And of course, we are restricting ourselves at the moment to the completely to the bosonic theory, where many of the most interesting problems can't be, unfortunately, discussed. So the basic idea of the split string field theory approach is to recast the string field, which is usually regarded as a functional of the string coordinate, or as a state in the Fock space of some conformal field theory. The two are related, of course, in this way, not as a operator on a different space, not the Fock space of the Neumann-Neumann boundary condition open string field, but rather as an operator on half string or split string Fock spaces. And the correspondence, roughly speaking, and I'll be a little bit more detail, is that, or the translation from this picture, of course, is that if you have a functional of a string x of mu, one of the bosonic coordinates of the string, where sigma runs from 0 to pi, you can break it up into its left and right pieces, regard it as a functional of the left and right coordinates separately, and then construct an operator which acts on the Fock space of half string states, half strings being strings on half the interval with Neumann-Dirichlet boundary conditions. The reason such a translation of the string field to this operator language is useful, of course, is that, as was originally noted in Witten's first paper, the star product looks a lot like ordinary matrix multiplication or operator multiplication in this language, since, as you recall, the star product was defined by simply gluing the right-hand side of the first string to the left-hand side of the second string, namely identifying R of sigma with L of sigma, which exactly corresponds to matrix multiplication. So the going from here to here is somewhat analogous to trying to realize the star product in non-commutative geometry, not in terms of the Moyal product, but in terms of matrix multiplication, where the observables of a non-commutative field theory are realized as operators in the ordinary Heisenberg Fock space. And anyone who's worked in non-commutative field theories knows that that by far is the simplest approach to dealing with a non-commutative product. Now, this thought is not particularly novel. It was evident in Ed's first paper. It didn't get very far, partly because Ed didn't believe it was going to get very far, and says so in his paper, which discouraged many people. Also, there are enormous difficulties in implementing this, having to do with a midpoint, and having to do with the nature of the derivation with Q, and so on. So this approach, by and large, hasn't really been seriously pursued. Now, one of the things that will make it a lot simpler for us to analyze this is the bold ansatz of Rostelli, Sen, and Zweibeck, which you've heard about, that if you want to describe the bottom of the vacuum, you shouldn't use Q, Q at the top. After all, Q, when you make a shift of the string field, Q changes. So we don't know what the appropriate description of the theory at the bottom is. And they made an ansatz that Q at the bottom can be taken to be only dependent on the ghosts. Now, Q, of course, its form can be changed by gauge transformations or field redefinitions. So there's a lot of latitude. And the main advantage of taking a Q formulated totally in terms of ghosts is, first of all, it's very easy to find nilpotent Qs of this type. In fact, it's almost too easy. You find a nilpotent Q independent of the dimension of the matter, which might appear a bit strange. It would seem to say that you could have a string theory not only in 26, but in 137 dimensions, which is equally OK. As far as I can see, there's nothing wrong with that. A theory down here has no physical states. So a theory that's totally empty can be totally empty in any dimensions. There's no reason why you should pick out 26 dimensions. The way the theory down here would pick out the critical dimension, by the way, this is some background independence already, right? The way you'd pick out 26 dimensions is Well, you have to find something physical that is sick, and the physical stuff would be the fluctuations around the solitons of this theory, or the closed string sector. In any case, for the kinds of simple cues that you can easily construct out of ghosts, it's trivial to see that they have trivial cohomology, namely any closed state is exact. So the advantages of the RSZ ansatz is that Q is very simple and easy to work with. As we'll see, the cohomology is trivial, so automatically there are no open string states. It does seem reasonable that you should, by some gauge and field redefinition, be able to find such a Q. And the one of the main technical advantages, as was described by, I'm sure, by S and Z, was that the string equations of motion separate. The matter equation of motion doesn't even involve Q and is easy to solve and has been solutions have been constructed by RSZ and by ourselves. And the ghost equation of motion, which I will discuss today, is also, well, that's the usual equation, but Q is much simpler. Now, I want to say a word about how closed strings are going to appear and present a point of view. There are no physical open string states, and the open string propagator is very trivial, but it's certainly possible that closed string states could appear at the one-loop level. And I'd like to make an analogy here, which I think is fruitful, and like all analogies, has some features that are really good and some that are bad. I'd like to compare this with QCD. In a sense, the open strings are like the quarks and gluons. The fact that there are no physical states at the classical level here corresponds to confinement. There are no physical quark and gluon states in QCD. The hadrons in QCD are somewhat like the closed strings, and they will appear as singularities in open string or quark gluon scattering amplitudes, and that's how you find them. Here, in open string theory, because of UV infrared, they appear already in the one-loop amplitudes. Of course, the analogy is somewhat flawed because these facts occur at the classical level, but there are no physical states, and closed strings appear at the one-loop level. Whereas in field theory, of course, such phenomena require a non-perturbative analysis. The hadrons are bound states, and confinement only occurs non-perturbatively. But that's because field theory doesn't have the UV infrared mechanism to play with. I would also like to remind you that the way things look in a theory like QCD can depend a lot on the choice of gauge or how one regulates the theory. And the best example for this is two-dimensional QCD, where Ed Hooft originally solved in light cone gauge. But even in light cone gauge, one needs to regulate the remaining gauge symmetry of the theory and regulate the gluon propagator, which is very singular at the origin. There are different ways of regulating that, and Ed Hooft cut out a little hole around Q plus equals zero. Callan and I looked at a somewhat more regular, less singular regularization, in which we just took the principal value of this propagator. The physical results in those two regularizations were identical, but the intermediate steps look totally different. In the first choice, the quark mass was infinite. It was very easy to see confinement or the decoupling of the quarks, but very hard to see hadrons, especially if you took the regulator to away epsilon to zero before you started trying to solve the beta sub eta equation, whose solutions are the spectrum of the hadrons, because the quarks had infinite mass. In the regular gauge, the quark mass was finite. You had quarks in the spectrum of the theory, but they decoupled on shell, which is the same as confinement, and it was much easier to see the appearance of hadrons or of asymptotic freedom. I think that somehow this choice of Q is similar to choosing the singular gauge and makes certain things like the decoupling of the open strings manifest, certain other things like the appearance of closed strings, and some other things, less manifest. A regular gauge is more like this, where Q is a much more complicated operator, harder to work with, but is more regular. And for such a regulator, there should very well exist some interesting dynamics in the open string sector, although again, the physical state should decouple at the bottom. Among the rest, under a gauge transformation, Q is not invariant, changes its form. By the way, this isn't exactly a choice of gauge, as it turns out. It's really a choice of definition of the theory. There is a third gauge, so-called choice of the gluon propagator, which is a physical one, has a nice Wick rotation, which doesn't confine, gives different physical results. It's another interesting feature of QCD2. These actually contain the instantons, and the other one doesn't. The instantons that you see if you put QCD on a sphere. But that's a longer story. I can talk about it privately. So, the first thing one does is discuss the theory in the matter sector, which is simpler. You don't have to make in this RSZ ansatz, you don't have to discuss Q. And that has been discussed by Barton and Ashok, I gather, at length. So I'm just going to go through it very fast and tell you how we do it in this split field formulation. So the idea is you have the string coordinate with its usual decomposition for Neumann-Neumann boundary conditions. You can break it up. You have a string. It has a midpoint. And therefore, you can translate x of sigma into two string fields which live on the half interval of Neumann-Dirichlet boundary conditions. And the translation between them is a unitary transformation in terms of this matrix x, whose zero component I haven't given, but it's essentially up to a factor of square root of 2, the same thing as this with n equals 0. So you can go back and forth between these different choices of coordinates. And essentially, following the prescription I had before, we can then translate a string functional of x into a string functional of psi left and right, and then construct an operator acting on the left, or on the half string space. In which case, the star product, where there are no anomalies at the midpoint in the matter sector, simply becomes the matrix multiplication. The integral, which is essentially defined by sewing the two halves, the right and left half side of the string together, obviously becomes the trace. These, again, are very reminiscent. Everything here is very similar to what non-commutative field theory, where also the integral in the operator language becomes the trace, and multiplication, the star product becomes operator multiplication. And the matter field equation then becomes just a projection. In other words, the matter field squared is equal to the matter field. That's the what the matter equation becomes. Now, the midpoint of the string is common to both sides of the string for a string that is smooth. And in this decomposition, the midpoint, it looks like L and R vanish at pi over 2. The cosine of an odd product of pi over 2 is 0. But of course, this is a legal Fourier expansion of a function on the half interval. So what happens is that if the coefficients here go like 1 over n, essentially, you can get a finite value of the midpoint. Whether or not the midpoint here is really fixed at 0 depends on the class of functionals you're allowing in this space, the class of states you're allowing in this space. And indeed, what kinds of operators or what portion of this abstract space you're considering is one of the crucial questions in the definition of the theory and its properties. In the matter sector, it's very easy, or in the ghost and matter sector, actually, to remove the midpoint dependence by subtracting from this coordinate its midpoint value, x bar being just the value of x at the midpoint. You can do the same for the L's by subtracting this term, which is what produces a non-vanishing of L and R at the midpoint, pi over 2, in which case you can regard, in fact, the string operator as a operator in a smaller space in which the string operator acts on Neumann-Dirichlet strings, which are fixed to be zero at the midpoint, and the midpoint then goes along for the ride as a ordinary, if you want, L squared Hilbert space of its own, and we have an operator on an ND string at each point x bar. This, of course, is possible because the star product preserves the midpoint. A operator of definite momentum then would just be a plane wave in the midpoint times a reduced operator acting on the Neumann-Dirichlet string at each point. Now, once you have reduced things, as in non-commutative field theory, where solitons always reduce to projections, it's trivial to find solutions. You just construct a projection operator. And one class of projection operators the simplest class is some normalizable function, say a Gaussian, for which you can do integrals. And this, for example, is a projection operator where I haven't put in the indices on this side. They're the same as on this side. You just have a Gaussian in the coordinates of the, so this is the functional that goes into defining the operator. This obviously is a product of a Gaussian on this space times another one, and is a projection operator. You can take a sum of these projection operators, orthogonal projections, give you another projection operator. So solution is trivial. Just like it's rather trivial to construct solitons in non-commutative field theories, as we've learned. Now, with this formalism, it's very easy to check. It's instructive to try to check the solution that was found by Kostoletsky and Potting and discussed at length by Rostelli, Sen, and Zweibach of the star projection operator, which would be psi equals psi star psi. We should find that solution in that language is just a projection in our language. So this is the sliver written in operator formalism. You've heard a lot about the sliver, but as a string state in Fock space, it's just it's a Bogdanov transformation of the vacuum with a matrix S here. And the first two authors made an ansatz like that and tried to see when you would get something which was a projection, which the star product closed. And they found with simplified ansatz for S, solutions. And in particular, a solution which is equivalent to the so-called sliver state. Now, to check that that's a projection in the half-string Hilbert space, what you have to do is first construct the functional. So you sandwich this with a position eigenstate. And of course, this will be a Gaussian then in the X's. A are linear combinations of X's and P's. And the matrix L is related to the matrix S simply in this way, where E is a diagonal matrix, which is essentially square root of N in the Fock space basis. So we have a space with a wave function like that. And given those transformation functions, we can replace the X's by the left and right and see if this wave functional indeed is a product of a Gaussian in the lefts and the right separately and involves no cross terms. For that to be the case, in fact, what's required is that this matrix L, that the odd and even components of this matrix L are simply related by those same X's. So that if L satisfy any matrix L here that satisfies this equation, where those X's, I remind you, is a very simple unitary matrix, matrix elements given there, then you have a wave function in the full string Fock space, which is equivalent to an operator that's a projection in the half-string space. And it's very straightforward to take the properties, to take the S that these people found and construct the L and show that L satisfies this equation. So the sliver state is indeed just a simple example of a projection operator. And that's why it's a solution. And the simplest sliver, the simplest solution of this type, in fact, is a Gaussian in all the coordinates of the string, therefore including the zero mode, something that's therefore localized in both space and time. Euclidean space and time and corresponds to a d minus 1 instanton, which should be the, which should be all brains, and multiple brains should be solitons of the stable vacuum. And that's the simplest one to construct, and it's a rank 1 projection. One can, of course, find many other solutions, infinite number of solutions of this equation. In fact, one can start in the in our split field formulation and construct lots of projections. Any state times any other times itself is a projection operator. But starting with this one, for example, one can easily shift the values and move it around, do things like change the width of the Gaussian. So you might ask, well, what is the meaning of the width of the d instanton? The d instanton is a Gaussian, but its width has no meaning. Just like the profile of a d brain in non-commutative field theory, the fluxon has no meaning. By a gauge transformation, you can make it look like a Gaussian around the center of the soliton, or you can make it look like some wild function. It has no gauge invariant meaning. Indeed, but you can do other interesting things. You can shift so that you lose the dimension on some of the space-time zero modes, any number that you want, and then get something which is localized in the transverse directions to the brain, but independent of as many dimensions you want, and those should be interpreted as DP brains all the way up to P equals 25. Now, these different descriptions are sort of, in many cases, appear to be simply related by gauge transformations. In fact, you know, in the naive sense, all rank 1 projections are equivalent. All rank R projections are equivalent by unitary transformations in a Hilbert space. But that's not necessarily exactly true. Here, unitary transformations, in fact, correspond to gauge transformations, just like they sort of do in non-commutative field theories. Gauge transformations that don't do anything in the ghost sector, but just change the matter fields. If that was really true, of course, then D brains at one point would be gauge equivalent to D brains at another point, which isn't true. In fact, if one looks at the unitary transformation that moves a D-brain in this language, change you from a projection operator that describes a D-brain here to one describes it here, that's actually a bad gauge transformation. What's a bad gauge transformation? Well, it's one that acts on states of the type we're considering. It takes you to an orthogonal space. So it has zero overlap. It takes you out of the Hilbert space you're considering. We don't really precisely know the precise definition of the space or the class of allowed operators, but we can recognize bad operators when we see them. And it's excellent that we have bad operators that therefore tell us that the translational degree of freedom of a D-brain is not just a gauge degree of freedom, it's a modulus of the solution. So one can construct then multiple D brains simply by taking projection operators of higher rank. Those could be D brains shifted, or D brains on top of each other, or D brains of different dimensions, whatever you want. It's as trivial as non-commutative field theories are. We can also see the tachyons in the usual way. If you take a given multiple D brain and perturb the action about that deep brain by exciting just the coefficients of the projections, then you easily see that around that deep brain, say a rank R deep brain, there are square tachyons. There are, most of the modes are massive, okay, outside that projection. And then the guys that connect the R times R projection elements of the operator to the other ones correspond to gauge transformations of the type that we've discussed here. So it's exactly the same as in non-commutative field theory. When you look at D brains, you discover that the dynamics of the D brains, of N D brains, is that of a UN gauge theory. Here, of course, we don't have yet the machinery to find all the dynamical degrees of freedom about the D brains. We'd like to see all the closed, the open string states, but we can begin to see at least the tachyons, which should be there. Sorry? No, not without a more complicated ansatz that involves the ghosts. Ah. Okay, so let me get to the meat of our second paper, which are the ghosts. Now, the ghosts are nastier. They're usually discussed as fermionic degrees of freedom. And that, however, is not very useful from our point of view, because the star product, it turns out, does not equate the ghosts on the right and left-hand side. In fact, equates them with a minus sign. Now, you might try to use fermionic coordinates in your string fields or in your string operators, but it doesn't look to be as simple as simply bosonizing them, which, in fact, is the strategy that Ed followed in his original paper, but was then dropped in string field theory, by and large, for good reasons. You can bosonize these ghosts in terms of a single bosonic field, which has this mode decomposition, and write in the Mandelstamian fashion the ghost fields, C's and B's, as exponentials of the right and left moving bosonic fields. And here is the decomposition. The ghost number, then, is just the momentum of the ghost field. These manipulating infinite products of creation-annihilation operators is rather singular. That's what produces the singularity, you know, the non-trivial singularities in the operator product expansion of these fields. And in order to be careful, we have introduced a regularization and kept track of it everywhere that puts in an x to the n in the commutator of the creation and annihilation operators so as to cut off divergent sums and then take x to 1 in the end. You really need to do that if you're going to carefully show that this thing is a delta function using algebraic techniques. Okay, if you've bosonized the ghosts, then, in fact, the bosonic coordinates of the ghosts, the string field is then a function of the bosonic ghosts, and the overlap conditions are the same as for any boson. The fields are equated on the right and the left, and so we can now define a half-string ghost state and replace the string field by an operator that acts on this state. Or indeed take out the midpoint as well as before. However, there is a tricky business with the ghosts, of course. There is a midpoint anomaly. The ghost current, ghost current, which is just the momentum of this bosonic field, has an anomaly, which comes from the Riemann curvature of the world sheet. The overlap, or the vertex of three-string vertex that defined Witten's overlap, had that anomaly concentrated as a delta function at the midpoint. And it tells you that in order to define the star product, the product of two functionals to get another one, you have to insert momentum 3/2 at the midpoint. And that can be done simply by inserting, in the usual star product language, or in our language, the operator e to the I 3 halves of phi bar, where this is the midpoint value of the field, what we call m, or if you had fields with definite momentum, it's just this function of the momentum of those fields. That is again, a simple multiplication. You just have this extra factor of m, and that also comes in the integral, which also has an anomaly with the opposite insertion of ghost number or momentum of phi. If you insert in the trace the operator m inverse, or if you consider states of definite momentum, you take the trace of something which has no momentum, you take out the momentum, and the integral is only non-vanishing if the momentum of the field or is 3 halves of the ghost number 3, and you can do the trace in the reduced Neumann-Dirichlet space. Now, the reason the bosonization wasn't used in, for example, all the work that's been done on formulating string field theory precisely, the kind of stuff that Javitki and I did or later worked, is that Q is nasty. Q is linear, after all, in C, but C is very complicated. Kink creation operator in the bosonic formulation. It helps a lot, however, to have the RZ ansatz, where Q could be taken just to be a simple linear function of C, and not things involving perhaps cubic functions of the ghost, fermionic ghosts. So we're going to take Q to be an arbitrary linear function of C, and we want to prove that as an operator on this half-string Fock space, Hilbert space, it has the requisite properties, which I've listed here. And in order to achieve the second property, that it's a derivation, integrates to zero, you must choose F to be symmetric around pi over 2. And you must choose this function to vanish at pi over 2 if you want to avoid problems at the midpoint. That means you're not allowed to choose F equals 1 or Q equals C naught. You are allowed to choose something like this combination, or in fact, any of the other combinations that R is Z use. And the reason is you don't want this Q to act at the midpoint. Not that you can't have Qs acting at the midpoint, it's just then you have to worry about anomalies. So how does Q act as an operator on our space? Well, essentially it's a soliton creation operator. C in the bosonic field theory creates kinks, solitons. You can see that by re-expressing in terms of shifts of the field and multiplication by the field. When you do so, you get an infinite factor from the moving around these operators. This is an infinity, so this operator acting on a field has a very simple thing. It shifts the field by a kink at some point mu, where C acts, creates a fermion soliton, multiplies it by a phase, which is just e to the I phi at that point, and then multiplies it by infinity. That infinite factor is absolutely necessary and will cancel when this operator acts on nice states. So, for example, if you take a nice state in the ghost Fock space and act with C plus or minus on it, you have to multiply it by infinity, because when you see what this shift does to the Gaussian wave functional here, you get an extra square of this shift in the components of the field summed over all n, which gives you an infinite factor of a zero factor of 1 over k. So you have to be careful in playing around with these operators. These operators are infinity times something which is just like a translation or explicitly a kink creation operator. And its properties will depend specifically and crucially on the kind of functionals you're working on, or the kind of operators, or the kind of states you're allowing in this Hilbert space of split strings. Well, then you can easily see what Q does on the half-string states, because Q breaks up into something acting on the left plus something acting on the right, and therefore QF on a string functional can be regarded as an operator, Q multiplying psi on the left, Q multiplying psi on the left with a on the right with a phase here that depends on the ghost number of the field. And Q, since it doesn't act at the midpoint, commutes with this midpoint insertion. And Q is just the same kink creation operator integrated over half the string. So it's something which, acting on a half string state, puts in a kink someplace between 0 and pi over 2, but not at pi over 2. Then it's very easy to see how YQ squared is 0. First of all, the operator, this operator itself, acting on the left Hilbert space, is nilpotent. And that's because when you take the square of it, you get us everything symmetric, and everything symmetric in this integral. Here you get the field shifted by two kinks. Doesn't matter which order you put them in. But when you bring one of these shifts through one of these phases, you get e to the I pi theta function, which is manifestly anti-symmetric. If this is either 0, or if you switch it 1, and e to the I pi is equal to minus e to the I pi times 0. So this is 0, but you might be worried because it's multiplied by infinity. You have a k squared there. And indeed, if this wasn't a nice functional, you can find functionals for which q squared is not 0. So the statement that q squared is 0 is a restriction on the Hilbert space, on the class of functionals. And what well-behaved means here is actually pretty weak. It's much weaker than being a Fock space-ish state. It really is only required this to have the same kind of asymptotic behavior that is like in the Fock space states in order for this shifted psi to have an effect of 1 over k squared that cancels this k squared. So for such well-behaved states, q squared is 0. And then q squared acting on psi in the usual formulation transforms into q acting on q psi, which is this. And then from the right to this, and q squared is 0. And these two terms cancel simply because of the change in ghost number. So q squared is 0 as an operator. The integral of q psi becomes the trace. And using the fact that this integral vanishes unless the ghost number is equal of psi equals 2, just from ghost number conservation, and q commutes with m, this just vanishes because of the cyclicity of the trace. And similarly, q is a derivation. That's, again, trivial algebra, and again, using the fact that q commutes with m. So all the axioms of open string theory are satisfied for QF and split string field theory for nice functionals. And nice functionals are essentially things which behave like Gaussians, just like free field operators, or in the left-right formulation like Gaussians, where the eigenvalues of this operator are like the Fock space. They go like n up to terms which vanish. What we need is only to get this 1 over k, and any correction to that which makes that sum a sum of 1 over n finite is OK. So it's a rather weak condition, and certainly satisfied by Fock space-like states. Well, so one of the immediate payoffs is we have we have what we would believe is a complete list of gauge invariant observables. Gauge invariants of the open string field theory, mind you, is just the following. This is a transformation of the field that is gauge invariant. We can translate that into our operator language by saying that delta psi is the commutator of a covariant derivative with a ghost number 0 gauge field, lambda, where this is the covariant derivative. It is multiplication by this half string q plus psi times this midpoint insertion thing. The field strength is related to the covariant derivative. It's the equation of motion, actually, for a Chern-Simons-like theory. And if you write out the operator in operator language, you easily see that this is the anti-commutator of two covariant derivatives. The reason the field strength is the anti-commutator, of course, is that we're dealing with a graded D. D has a ghost number 1. The field, this covariant derivative, which in a sense acts on the left, the half-string Hilbert space, which is like, you know, a field in the fundamental representation and not the adjoint representation, has gauge invariant eigenvalues. Under a gauge transformation, it shifts by a commutator. The eigenvalues of D are gauge invariant. And in a gauge, this looks just like non-commutative field gauge theory, and we know what all the gauge invariant operators are. They are the eigenvalues of D and nothing else. So the claim would be that if this formulation, you know, would be complete, that the complete set of gauge invariant observables of open string field theory are simply arbitrary functions of the eigenvalues of D. You can construct things that look somewhat like straight line Wilson loops in non-commutative field theory, except that this D doesn't have any index. I mean, it's normal to have a covariant derivative non-commutative gauge theory that doesn't depend on X, just an operator. But there, at least, you have indices. You know how to construct paths that this D parallel transports you around. Here, you have no idea what the underlying space is. And so it's a wonderful open question as to how to find any interesting and meaningful physical observables in terms of this. But this is it, if this formulation is correct. Anything you'll ever be able to construct that's physical is contained in these eigenvalues. And some of them you might expect would couple to closed string states, just like they do in non-commutative field theories. A few more minutes, you're going to tell me, but I'm the director. So I have just a few more. I knew this was going to happen. This is shortening this talk I gave 2 days ago in Israel, where things are quiet and there's no pressure. It took me 3 hours, but I'm I have 5 more minutes. Ghost solution. Now, one of the main advantages, if correct, of this operator formalism is that, you know, this is a quadratic equation, and it's easy to solve. And like all non-commutative field theory solutions, it's just projection operators once again. We want to solve this equation. So we first construct the ghost projector, which is chi equals chi star chi, if you want. Here we have this m. Well, so that means that chi is m inverse times the projection. And you can easily use as the projector here, if you want, the sliver state, the ghost sliver that RSZ proposed, or other presumably equivalent ways of representing good projections. Having found a projector, let's try a psi of this form, 1/2 q chi plus chi q. This is not an exact field, because since chi has ghost number 0, q chi would really be the same thing with a minus sign here. But this is nice because it makes the equation of motion equal to the following, q chi q equals something, something, plus something. And so we try to make these two vanish, and this chi m chi, if chi is a projection, just reproduces this side. So this will equal this, and these two will be 0 if chi is a projection, and if chi m q chi is 0. And that's not difficult to achieve. It's easy to see that. Now, this is just a condition on chi. You could also regard it as a condition on q. And remember, we have an infinite class of q's with arbitrary those functions f. So if we have one q for which this doesn't vanish, we find another q for which this doesn't vanish. So we've failed twice. We take a linear combination that works. So there's a codimension one class of q's in this set of all q's that for which we can construct such projections and therefore solutions of the ghost equations of motion, which are constructed out of projections, any rank you want. Rank 1 is the simplest. It's kind of interesting that if you take the rank to infinity, chi goes over into m inverse times the identity then. And that's a little bit of a singular case, to say the least. The shifted q, if you perturb around this ghost solution, goes to 0, and you get to the cubic equation, much as many people in the past thought you could shift to. In that case, we would interpret, if this has any validity at all, which is tricky to say the least, the cubic field theory by itself with q equals 0 would describe simply an infinite number of D-brains, presumably, in this case, D-brains of any kind. Infinite number of D instants, infinite number of D25 brains, anything you want, but n somehow would have to be, the rank would have to be infinity. I don't know what that means. Now, there is one problem in all this success, and that is that when we calculate the action around the ghost action for this solution that we find, we get something which has trace q, chi q, chi q, which is zero, using the cyclicity properties of the q. This is not just for the solution I showed you, but generic. In the split field formulation, at least, any solution of the equation of motion, just by manipulating using the properties of q and the cyclicity and the derivation, gives you zero action. Now, what does that mean? You should be able to calculate the action and get the difference between the action at the top of the hill and the bottom of the hill, which is finite. It's equal to the deep brain tension. There are a bunch of possible explanations. It could be that the solutions we want are good, correspond to operators in this Hilbert space that are good enough so that the axioms of string field theory are valid, but not good enough to be able to do some of the manipulations I did here. The solution I think is correct is that we simply don't know the normalization of this action. Remember that at the bottom of the hill, there's no physics at the classical level, so there's absolutely no way of normalizing this action. Unlike at the top of the hill, where you can compare it with string theory, say perturbation theory. And I would like to push the point of view that the Arzianzatz is analogous to the singular gauge in QCD2, as I said before, which makes everything confinement or decoupling manifest. But it's very hard in this gauge or in this ansatz to see the decoupling of open string states. And the reason is that if you gauge fix and look at the open string propagator, it's essentially one. Now, if you have a propagator that's essentially one, you're never going to get closed string states by looking at the annulus diagram. They come from the ultraviolet, but here you've put all the ultraviolet to infinity before you start calculating the annulus. So it's hopeless. It's somewhat similar to taking a theory like this and taking the mass to infinity so as to decouple all the modes of phi. But you've taken to infinity in such a way that the propagator goes like 1. Namely, you've multiplied the action by 1 over m squared. As m goes to infinity, the propagator goes to 1 indeed. And it's hard to see any interesting dynamics in loop diagrams. But of course, you've multiplied by 0 to get this to happen. So I would conjecture that what happens in this action compared to the original action is that there's an overall normalization factor of 0 in front of this action, which we have no way, really, except by comparing. I mean, if we believe it, we know what the normalization is. We've got to multiply this action by 1 over 0. That's how you do it. You look at something physical, like the deep brain tension. Anyway, we don't know the answer to this, and the only way, I think, to really resolve this problem, assuming, of course, that the Arzianzatz is not as correct, would be to regularize this gauge choice to go to more complicated cues, which I think we have to do anyway to see closed string states. So let me end with some conclusions. What we think we've done is describe open string field theory as an algebra of operators on split string states. I described to you the space, a Q, so on. We verified the axioms of open string theory for this simple infinite class of Qs. We found solutions both in the matter and the ghost sector and constructed a complete set of gauge invariant observables. Now, all of this I regard as a small step, very small, towards realizing open string field theory. Perhaps, and I see no reason why it couldn't be, a background-independent, non-perturbative formulation of all of string theory. And among many other things, at the very least, we should go on and understand Qs which are less singular and learn how to solve the classical equations for them. We don't see any obstacles to doing that. It's just trickier. Explore the physical spectrum, find the closed string states, and so on. Take those observables and try to understand them. How do you take those covariant derivatives that parallel transport you somewhere and construct correlation functions, perhaps of closed string states? Could these observables be useful for exploring closed string tachyon condensation or things like that? Most ultimately, one would like to, instead of constructing this operator formulation about a particular background, construct an abstract formalism that allows you to find this realization, this operator realization, as the solution of the equations of motion. So, in other words, you'd have an abstract operator formalism, and then ansatzes you'd make to solve the classical equations of motion. Part of the ansatz would be a realization of the abstract formulation as operators in a particular Hilbert space, and then you'd be finding the background in that way. And then, of course, one has to generalize all of this to the superstring, which has enormous problems of its own. Thank you.
Well, in view of the time, we should probably only take a couple of brief questions.
Barton.
First, an observation and then just a question. In the action, the word taking with pure ghost, certainly D equal 26 doesn't appear from Q squared, but would appear from the associativity of the cubic interaction.
From the what?
Associativity of star. You really... Yeah, I think you proved it to yourself.
No.
And you need a conformal map to re-smooth the star.
It is true that if you take Q equals to, if you take the formulation Q, you mean A star B?
No, just the star being associative requires the.
Not in our form. No, I don't see it.
Anyway, another the question is, when you restrict
hard in proving the axioms using the Fock space thing, you know, which we. Antal and I did and showed that it only works in 26 dimensions. There are a lot, most of the axioms fail except in 26 dimensions because of anomalies at the midpoint. But that was because Q was non-trivial at the midpoint. And one of the advantages of this ansatz is that it's possible to take Q, and everything I said had, you know, all the proofs I said had to do with Q that vanishes at the midpoint. When Q doesn't vanish at the midpoint, then you clearly have anomalies.
That I think has to do with proving that it's a derivation, but
yes.
We'll talk more. Now, about these Qs like C0 that don't vanish at the midpoint,
yeah.
We would think they're really interesting, so I would like to know if you think it's just a technical problem with doing a split string formalism with them, or that would change the space of functionals, or what's the problem really?
I think it's a technical problem, but one that's very difficult to deal with. I regard this ansatz really as some kind of limit. If you tried to get it continuously, but it's some kind of limiting singular case. And certain things might not be easy to disentangle with that limit. You'd have to regulate it somehow. And in regulating it, you'd go away from that. So there might very well be a way of dealing with, in fact, you see that already there might be a way of dealing with such cues, but only if you're able to regulate a bit. And the advantage at this level, before you go to look at closed string states of the cues that vanish at the midpoint, is that you don't require that regularization to be explicit.
Okay, one more brief question.
Well, I don't know how useful it is, but it seems to me that in boundary string field theory, the action has a very definite normalization. So if one understood more clearly the relationship of these theories to the boundary string field theory. And a related remark is that in boundary conformal field theory, the tension of brains is very generally related to a regularized dimension of the Chan-Peyton-Hilbert space.
Yeah, I mean, will get the right, you'll get all the tensions correctly up to an overall constant. I mean, the ratios of tensions will come out correctly. 0/0 is 1. These brains do have all the right intentions, if you're simply saying you're using an action whose normalization you don't know. Unless you have some way of fixing the normalization of an ansatz like of the action for an ansatz like this, you have absolutely no way of calculating the absolute difference, because you have no independent way of calculating the normalization of the action at the bottom. After all, there's no physics at the bottom perturbatively. So the only thing you could do would be to normalize it by... So I don't think... if we got a finite answer, we wouldn't be perturbed at all, even if it didn't agree with anything else. But zero makes you worried, but I don't think zero is any different than any other number. And there's reasons, there's reasons why it is, because you've taken some limit where the propagator becomes one. And that's hard to see how you haven't divided by zero, multiplied by zero, to get the propagator to be one. Ed?
I think you managing every bit quantum corresponds to a thing in the inner dimension. Tomorrow is maybe you can worry technically about the dimension. And that's why that will tend to make the action zero.
Yeah. Why will it tend to make the action zero?
Well, suppose Q was an honest inner dimension.
Then you could shift it away. Then you would have had the phi cubed action.
Mm-hmm.
And for the phi cubed action, the equation of motion is phi squared equals zero, which makes phi cubed zero.
Yeah. I think the rank of this, when the rank of the projection, sorry, you know, that's yet another limit. I'd hate to have to base the argument on. But, right. But what does that lead you to conclude? That this, I mean, it would seem to me if you, wouldn't you have said, I don't want to put words in your mouth, that since Q isn't an inner derivation, an ansatz that assumes that it is fishy?
Okay, well, I think at this point I'll assert my authority as chair. Now, just before we thank David again, I would like to make two brief announcements. Speakers, please turn in your transparencies for scanning. If you don't turn them in very soon and you leave, then we won't have a record of what you said. And secondly, since the director gave himself a 5-minute reprieve, we will not start again until 11:25. So let's thank David again.